Welcome to Audiology Mastery, where we discuss how audiology and hearing aid practice owners can increase revenue, improve patient and employee satisfaction, and live a better, more balanced life. I'm your host, Kevin St. Clergy, and today I'm joined by Jesse Aldous, a previous successful audiology practice owner, independent practice broker, and a business coach. Jesse, welcome to the show.
Appreciate your time, Kevin.
Well, I always like to start off with this first question because it's always fascinating to me to find out how people got into the profession. So what inspired you to pursue a career in audiology and hearing aids?
So like a lot of us, I went to the path after high school into college trying to discover what I wanted to do and realized I wanted to be in business, wanted to be something, a capacity of helping individuals, looked at counseling, looked at entrepreneurship. And then when I found, had a friend who bought an audiology practice and he recruited me in after spending some time in the practice and seeing that you could impact the quality of individuals' lives, I got hooked immediately on the idea of being able to help people improve their life through communication.
And how did that lead to private practice?
So, you know, I spent a couple of years with that office and we grew that office. We grew it from being, you know, single location, small office, and we grew it into a strong office. And after that, I thought, okay, I think I have a knack for this. I think I want to be an owner. So I went out and found some offices that one of the manufacturers owned that were in the red, losing money. And I set up an agreement with him that I could come take over the practice, grow the practice, and then buy it from him. That worked out pretty well. So I bought a couple part-time practices that were doing about $260,000 in revenue. And as most people know, that's not a lot. And I was able to grow those to 6 full-time practices that were very thriving and strong in our marketplace.
That's great. Walk us through how you went from one location to, I believe, was it like 17 or 18 or 14, something like that?
Yeah. So basically, I did not open a bunch of new clinics. My strength was finding small offices that were doing 10 or 12 units and 20,000 a month and growing them up to do 60, 70,000, 100,000 a month. So the 5 locations and 1 part-time, so 6 total, we got those to about 3 million in revenue. That took some time and growth. A couple of years in a row, we were growing about 30% a year. And, you know, I worked a ton. One of the busiest years, I went from 3 locations to, I planned on opening 1 location and ended up going from 3 to 6 in 1 year because I had a couple opportunities that dropped in my lap and we opened and ran. And that caused me to work a lot of hours for about 18 months. And if I could do it again, I probably wouldn't have, Kevin, to be honest, because it was so much work. But I got through that. That was the one season of being an entrepreneur that it was definitely stressful when you're working and looking at your finances on a weekly basis and growing. And I really learned what it took to expand. And so it was a great experience for me. So got up to that 6 locations. I had a partner that bought me out the majority of my ownership. And that was a great opportunity because he was a much bigger operator and it was like getting an MBA, going to dive from a couple million-dollar operation into a much bigger organization and learn from that side. But my primary role in that partnership was to go out and acquire and grow businesses. So then maintained a ownership that I went out and grew from 6 to 14 locations. And that's where I got on the beginning of my acquisition experience, starting to value practices, integrate them into the group, and grow them. Again, I didn't buy a lot of established great practices. I bought a lot of practices that had challenges. And then eventually exiting all those locations into one of the major manufacturers. Post-acquisition, I worked for about 14 months, helping to source deals and do evaluations and due diligence. Another great experience. So what I love about my current business is that I work with independent audiologists, helping them to appropriately value their practice and exit successfully. But I've had the opportunity to be a part of a lot of audiology deals. And so that experience helps me to do a good job of it as advising those clients.
What are some of the challenges that really stick in your mind as you went from 1 to 6? And then 6 to 14, what would you say were your top 3 challenges during those periods of time?
So the first challenge that every owner faces is to stop working in the business. And I still work with audiologists that'll have 10 locations and they're still seeing patients. That to me is criminal. You know, that means you're not taking care of your business. If you're sitting knee-to-knee with a patient, you are generally for sure not taking care of your employees and your business as much as you should be. So getting out of the clinic so I'm not seeing patients and becoming a good provider is crucial so you know, understand what it takes to have a healthy office, but then being able to train and set systems up and a culture that reinforces your providers and your PCCs to handle patient care as you would. So first challenge is you stepping out of the business and starting to operate the business. So going past that 2 or 3 locations into the 5, 6, sometimes that's a pretty big challenge because at that point, you have to become a business. You have to get enough revenue so you can step back, still pay yourself enough to stay alive. But a lot of your margin starts to go to payroll that you used to be comfortable taking home. So I think that was the first challenge. And you got to grow big enough because as soon as you step out of the clinic, now you feel like I need an HR person, I need a marketing person, but you're doing all those hats. And where people, I think, fail is in the middle. When you go from a million, million and a half trying to get to 2 and 3, you've got to grow at a quick enough pace that you don't fail, but also quick enough so you can get enough margin to go walk through that steps. And so I think that was the first big challenge. The second challenge is it's so easy to get caught up in the day-to-day and not delegate to offices. So when I started expanding out of the state I was in, I realized how much the clinic didn't need me. When I went into the clinic, they were used to me being there and they used me. But when I started hiring people 10 hours away from me, I would just set the expectation. You're now running this office. You're the patient care coordinator. You're the provider. And I would step away. Now, I'm going to be 10 hours away. So if you guys have a problem, you can call me on the phone. We're doing our weekly meetings. But I really delegated better versus when the clinics were an hour from me. I thought I was doing a good job by being in there. And really, when I finally realized that I set the expectations with my team and each of my offices that my goal is to show up every 3 months and take you guys to lunch and us not even talk about business. That means we're successful. That means you guys know what you need to do. You're hitting your numbers. You're helping the patients that we're putting in front of you. I'm providing the opportunities through a good marketing campaign. That became the goal. And so once I really realized that, that was a big catalyst for change and growth. But I think the third one I would mention is growing into this bigger location, the part that I brought on having over 120 locations. As an owner, you can look around your clinic and say, this is what's happening. I see this patient experience. When you grow to 6, 8, 10 locations, you can't be in that location. So you have to then start relying on your data. And most individuals don't spend enough time looking at their numbers to understand the relationship of percentage of change and whether it's new patient acquisition cost or your help rates. And so you really have to rely on the data because you can't go walk into that office and see exactly what's happening. You have to look at the numbers. And that's a whole other skill set. So that was a big growth point for me to be able to look at numbers. And now I average 2 to 3 evaluations a week, Kevin. So I look at a lot of audiology P&Ls. So if when someone sends me a P&L and I can look at a couple of years within 20, 30 minutes, I usually can identify some of the key problems because they're similar, whether it's in Louisiana or in California or Texas, and the numbers tell that story.
Tell us about some of the things you see the most when you're looking at a P&L, because that's interesting. Because, well, first of all, I really try to encourage people to set aside a time each month to look at their P&Ls. Know your numbers is what I like to say when I'm coaching a client. But talk to us about what you look for, what you see, because I find similar things, but I'd love to hear it from another perspective.
The first step is just knowing the numbers, right? It's always surprising when I dig into numbers and I go, hey, your cost of goods is this, your marketing is this, your percentage of labor is this, and you have an owner who's owned an office for 10 years and they don't know, is 35% good or is that bad? Is 22% good for staffing? So I think the first encouragement I see is understanding what the data is and what it should be. And when someone says, what's your business model? Well, your business model is understanding those percentages. And it's really not overly complicated when you look at, I've got $100,000 in revenue, $2 million in revenue. How does that revenue break down as a percentage? The thing that I see most often is one, individuals not knowing it, but what do I see in the P&Ls that is most surprising is how often staffing is too high and marketing is too low.
Interesting. Okay.
And we don't see the correlation of our pricing to our cost of goods. So those are the two main issues. So starting with the first one, very often I'll see pricing is 36% for staffing. And is that an okay amount? And then the owner feels like, well, I love my people. I want to pay him more. And I'm afraid of paying him too much. And really having a too high a percentage of staffing generally isn't that you're paying the employees too much. It's that you haven't organized your business in a way to help that employee to be most effective. And the goal is for their wages to go up. And that's generally an inverse relationship to the marketing. The biggest mistake I see audiology owners make is not marketing effectively. I see all the time. In fact, sometimes they'll brag about it. I did an evaluation a couple of weeks ago and the audiologist said, we spend zero on marketing, you know, and it's like, well, that's not a good thing because you're not providing enough opportunities for your providers. So you'll see 4% marketing and 36% staffing. Now, what I recommend generally is let's increase the marketing. Let's track it effectively so that you can see the results of how many new patient opportunities you're putting into the office. And then you'll start to see that percentage your staffing percentage go down because those employees are more effective. They're producing more happy patients, which produces more profits. So that would be a really common correlation. I mean, it's surprising when I look at a P&L that has an adequate amount of marketing.
We did a podcast with Madison Levine, who has a great practice down in Charlotte, North Carolina. She said she had dramatically increased her pay-per-click spend. And no, this is not a shameless plug from MPB, but it's just something she experienced. And she's like, you know, when I started spending more, I know what happened. She started outbidding some of her competitors, but she started getting a return. And I think it's just learning where to put your money in the right places and tracking the results you're getting so that you can look at your cost per lead, your cost per appointment, and your total sales by medium so you can make good decisions. But I hear that too. I hear it often. Hey, I cut all my marketing and revenue actually went up. Well, as a broker, I've done it for years. Now you do all of our broker deals, Jesse. It's probably not a good thing for someone to see that they're not doing any marketing, or maybe they see it as an opportunity. But I think the biggest thing is if they're not marketing, they're not driving their revenue up where they could actually get more money if they exited. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Another part is just control and liability. I have a client who their revenue dropped by 20-30%, and they look back and say, I don't know what happened and why. Well, when you're not in control of the patient flow and you're not tracking that, you're just hoping everything works out, then your revenue can change and fluctuate. Whereas if you have a strong marketing campaign, if all of a sudden one area starts to drop, you're watching those numbers and you can affect change. So as you see opportunities in an office, and you know the traffic flow that I always looked for was 10 was poor, 40 was amazing in one location. So if you've got that 20 benchmark and all of a sudden it drops down to 15 or 16, if you're paying attention to that, you can then push marketing in another area to get that number back up, continue to make that audiologist effective in that market.
So are you talking 20 new patients a month, 40 new patients a month?
Yeah, so 40 new opportunities, opportunities that a provider can then say, yeah, I recommended hearing help for.
Okay, so you liked two a day, two per day. That's a great goal. I love that.
Yeah, and it's possible. And again, these are things that I didn't know when I was a small operation. And these are things I learned from the partner I brought on. I've shared this at some conferences, but the biggest thing I learned was, you know, I was marketing at 6%. When I took the clinic group, the six offices we had, we went to 18%. We tripled our profit margin. So we tripled how much net profit was coming into the office. Same amount of providers. We just gave them more opportunities. I felt like I was, as an operator, I felt like I was a pretty sharp marketer. I knew what my new patient acquisition cost was. I was paying attention to it. I had a marketing budget. I followed up monthly, but I was afraid to spend the money. And reasonably so, because it was my money. It was in my account. I didn't want to. I was like, gosh, if I take 10 grand, what if I lose it? I had the wrong mindset. And the law of the lid, it's a, you know, concept Maxwell teaches, but you can only grow to the point that you are. So your business can only grow as much as you can grow as an individual. And me as an individual, it took somebody else coming to my practice as a partner and saying, we've got to grow this. Let me show you how this works, to show me how much I was leaving on the table. And that's the lessons I help other owners to recognize. Don't do what I did. Grow your practice without having to bring a partner in. I preach it a lot. And the thing that I like about preaching is I don't have anything on the marketing side. I don't run a marketing company, but that's why I coordinate with you, Kevin, because I trust you and I trust your team and your group. And so anyway.
There's another word I've heard of called the Peter Principle. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
It's actually a great book. There's a little bit more to it than this, but the basic principle is we all work our way up to the level of our incompetence.
That makes sense.
For me, we grew a company to a certain size, then we sold, and then we joined as owner in a new group. Very much same story as what we've done the last couple of years, and it's worked really well. But it's been fascinating how you can learn when you join a bigger company or whatever to know what's next. And what you're talking about is managing by the numbers, which I think is something that a lot of people haven't learned yet.
Yeah, 100%. And spending time in the numbers is not the most exciting part of your business, but it's the crucial part of your business. If you don't know those numbers, you know, the business can go up, can go down, but you're not in control.
Well, since you brought up marketing, and this is not a shameless plug for MedPB, but I would like to hear what you feel are effective marketing strategies and some tips that you can share with our listeners on what they can do from a marketing perspective to hit the numbers you just mentioned.
It's key to track. And there's so many systems nowadays. A lot of offices will lament about back in the day when I could throw out a newspaper ad and a direct mail and it just always worked. I mean, we've all heard that. I'm sure you've heard a lot more than I have, Kevin, but it was a different market back then. And today though, the benefit is we can track things so much more effectively. So we can actually see how much money did it cost me to get this person to click on my website, to click on my Facebook page? What was like my cost per lead, my cost per call? That data is so much easier to track today. So first we have to set up a plan. What needs to happen in your office? How many opportunities in the specific location? If you're seeing 16 opportunities, what's the capacity? And then from there, we make, you know, we want to put 10 opportunities, 15 opportunities, and we want to decide what could we pay for those and create a range. Because if you come into this place of like, I just want to spend $1,000 and get 5 patients, that's never going to happen, right? So, but you can say, what could I pay? And at what point do I cut off marketing? At what point do I love it? And for me, you know, if I could pay $300-$400 for a new patient appointment and we can close 50% of those, somewhere in that $700-$800 per new patient acquisition cost in a private pay model, that makes sense. So once we have the framework of what we can pay, then we start talking about how do we do it. So we got to establish the why first, and then we go into the what, like how do I actually make that happen? I'm always blown away how often individuals are not effectively marketing their database. They have this idea, and I was the same way, that these patients love me, we do a great job, they're never leaving. I guarantee you they're leaving. They're leaving because someone else is marketing to them. Another reason that it's such a bad plan to not market is because your own database is leaving, going other places because they're being marketed to. So by working to your database, the database is the first step. That's the lowest hanging fruit. You should have a very clear plan. Segment your database into different buckets from 3 to 4 year patients, total database, prospects, leads, and then figure out what message do I send to that. My message to my TNSs is different than my 3 year patients. And we need to craft that message. And then we need to measure, did that work? Did it not work? I think the mistake that so many offices make is they put all that on a company like you, Kevin, or another company and say, just send the patients to me. And you guys are usually missing a key component of what happened. What was that patient? And was it a good patient? And did they buy? And what was my ROI on it? So database marketing is crucial. From there, I think I'm pretty excited about a lot of options with digital. And being able to dominate your digital space should be every audiologist's goal. Looking at your market, going in and Google searching hearing aids in my location. And if you're not in that top 3 position, you're losing market share. The best story that I have is we took every one of our locations to over 100 reviews. Now, most of them are in 200 and 300. But back when no one else had close to 100 five-star reviews, most of them had 5, 6, 8 in my market. We made that aggressive goal to get to over 100. I remember a story. A provider told me that there was a competitor right down the road from us. The individual had a hearing test. The provider walked out the door to get the contract to fill it out. And why he was getting the contract, he Google searched hearing aids in my location and found that we had 127 five-star reviews. They had 20. And he stopped the appointment, walked across the street, ended up buying from us. So that being the authority digitally is crucial. And that's our main street today. So database, digital. And then from there, we start looking at what's in your market that we can work. But if you have a framework of what you can spend, you've got to be brave enough to go spend the money. I remember I had a marketing outreach idea that cost me $15,000. I put that money out. Long-term, it ended up being a great part of my program that we grew our practice with. But I had to be willing to risk the $15,000 to try it out and measure it and see that it worked.
I think you're a fan of marketing automation because that's kind of a buzzword right now.
Absolutely, absolutely. So again, we can say, gosh, I loved when we could just send out a newspaper ad. But what we didn't have back then that we have today is we have the ability with technology to look at what's our perfect patient experience. And if you can think about your patient from what you want them for the first call, what you want them to see in your website, your front office, how they answer the phone, and then post-sale, how can we defensively communicate with a patient when they buy, when they don't buy, when they come in for a clinic check? We can automate all of this now. And your database, if you take your database and section off how many potential purchases you have, and then look at what you're actually getting, you'll be floored. You might look at it and say, gosh, we have 600 patients that could buy, they're at 340 years, and only 48 of them bought. You go, wow, there's a lot of people that aren't buying. And guess what? It's because they're buying other places. They're going to Costco or they're buying online. So if you could automate that, so you could communicate with that person at the moment that they're thinking, gosh, these hearing aids are working okay. Should I think about some new ones? And that's when they're getting an email, a text message, a voice call. If you're not automating your processes, they're available. They're out there. You're leaving money on the table for sure.
I know you and I got in a discussion about direct mail, how we think direct mail is not dead. You're seeing the same thing I am. The people that are doing some direct mail are having some pretty good success with it. It's kind of an 80-20 for me. 80% of the time, it seems to be working pretty well with the right list and the right letter as the two things. But I think, and tell me if I'm wrong, but I think a lot of people will try something once and then say, it doesn't work, not in my area. Any advice on direct mail and that attitude?
I had come to the conclusion that direct mail is dead. And I ran the numbers and I ran it multiple times. It didn't work for me. And I was that same owner that I had 4 or 5 different runs and I ran the numbers and I lost money. I was paying for new patients. And I thought, gosh, that doesn't fit my model. Again, when the partnership that bought me out, one of the things they showed me was how much marketing we had to do, how much direct mail and how often, and then not just off of 4 runs, but off of 25 runs and in different areas. And once we looked at the data with more data and a longer duration, it worked financially and it paid off. You can't try marketing. You have to put together a strong plan and you have to invest the money. And part of the investment is finding out what isn't working. But direct mail, especially from a database side, I think is a home run. That's a pretty easy one to track the ROI on. And still, again, if you're working with the right group and the right message, and you layer that with digital and mail, I think that's a pretty effective tool. And that's why there's still millions of pieces of mail going out to our users.
So what I hear you saying is don't get focused on one or two things. You need to do it all and be aggressive, or somebody else will.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you've definitely lived the American dream. It sounds like you sold your practice not once, but twice, which is cool. I love that. But I think there's a lot of listeners that maybe towards the end of their career, or there's some people out there that just don't want to do this for the rest of their natural life and they're looking to sell, but they're not sure what to do. What would you say are the next 2 to 3 steps? If somebody's thinking about selling or wants to sell right away, besides contacting you, what are some things that they need to prepare for?
I think the best thing to look at is every business will exit. Whether you love your practice or not, at some point you won't be in your practice. A natural progression of every business is the exit. And so making a proactive plan for that exit is the biggest mistake individuals make. They decide to start thinking about this the year they want to sell. And so a couple of things that would help increase the success would be, one, clean books. Understanding how your books look and what they need to be. If you have a really clean set of, you know, as far as your database, whether you're using Cycle or Blueprint or what, that system is nice and clean and intentional, and you have intentional processes for your staff to use that, that then translates into a clear QuickBooks and a profit and loss that's clean with a chart of accounts that makes sense. And then that moves into taxes. If there's a huge difference between those three documents, anybody who's purchasing, they're looking at those three documents and they need to make sense and they need to be clean. And so spending the time to invest with an accountant to make sure that your financial health is strong is step one. Step two is, if you're generating the revenue in your business, if you're the primary audiologist providing all the services, either one, you need to work hard enough to transition yourself out of that so that you can sell a business that has a staff in place that you're not the one that's doing all the sales, or you need to plan on staying on for 2 or 3 years. So if you're planning on retiring in 5 years, you should probably sell in 2 to 3 years and then plan on staying on for a couple of years with the person who buys it, because your value of you creating the revenue, you can't sell yourself and then retire the same day. That affects the valuation greatly. And the other side, I think, is having an evaluation. One thing that I did is I had someone put an offer on my business when I was at right about $1 million in revenue. And the offer came in and I looked at it and it was a big number. And my wife and I have talked about it, and I'm so glad we turned the offer down. But that offer was a great opportunity for me because it made me go back, and it had nothing to do with the value of my business, but I had to write down a number and realize, what would the number need to be for me to financially feel comfortable that with my family and be able to walk away from having to work? And I wrote that number down, and beginning with the end in mind, once I had the number, I thought that number might take me 10 years to get to. And 4 or 5 years later, I sold at that number and it was a wonderful thing. So I would encourage you, pick the number and figure it out and then have an evaluation and see how far you're off. If you want $400,000 for your business or you want $4 million for your business, the math's going to have to make sense. It doesn't matter what your emotional side of your business. And that's something else that's tough, because you know, you might spend 20 years in your business and that might not be worth that much if you haven't grown it. So find out what the realistic number is. And then if you don't like that, figure out how to grow it.
Okay. So a lot of times you'll do evaluation. You probably saw the same thing. I've done them for years. I know you do them as well. I know for a fact that there's only two things that happen. They're either really upset or they're really happy. And a lot of times they're disappointed of what their practice is worth on paper. Which brings me to my next question. A lot of times people will call me and say, what's my practice worth? You know, here's what I did last year. I did $1 million. What's my practice worth? It's not that simple, is it? Talk to us about how you value a business and how it's different depending on who they want to go out and sell to. Because I know some people don't want to sell to a manufacturer because they want an individual to continue that same level of service. Go into that a little bit, because I know you have had several conversations about it, but I would really like the listeners to hear your approach.
Well, I love, Kevin, that you've had some opportunities where people are happy about your valuations, because it feels like most of the time when I show the number that they're a little bit discouraged. And the goal is teaching and explaining why it is there. And generally, you know, I was the same way. I wanted more for my practice than it was worth when I got that first offer. But that a moment in time I realized what I need to make my practice into so that my expectations and the value align. I think one thing that's good to identify in our industry is manufacturers have inflated our valuations. If manufacturers were not out buying clinics, the value would be much lower. And I think that when you look at a big group buying a small group, there's pros and cons with that. And I think that we have to be realistic about what those are going to be. And from a legacy standpoint, when you want to hand it off to an employee or an individual, you have to look through and make the correct planning with the valuation. But fundamentally, valuations are based on cash flow for most every business. So when you look at evaluating whether it's an audiology business or a chiropractor or dental business, it has to do with how much cash flow and discretionary cash flow is there available for the potential investor who's going to pay for the business. And in our industry, that's been skewed some because manufacturers are buying more for market share. And so when I talk to individuals about owning, my goal is to get the best value out of their practice, but also to align them with the best fit. Because for me, like when I went to market, there was a couple individuals that were buying out there that never got to the table. I wouldn't even talk to them because I'd seen how they treat their employees. And I love my employees and my patients. And I thought, you know, there's no way I'm going to let my employees work for that group. So they never got the option to even put an offer on my practice. And I think that most owners feel the same way. We want to have someone who takes our practice and works hard and takes care of our patients and our providers. So that being said, we need to look at the buyer makes a big impact. Who's buying? And I think aligning, whether it's an individual or it's a strategic group that has 20 offices, or if it's a manufacturer, and what I try to help individuals understand is the pros and cons of all of those and what aligns with their goals. But cash flow, health of the business, margins, all of those drastically affect. I can tell you one of the biggest factors today, Kevin, I won't do an evaluation on an audiology clinic if I don't have a good understanding of their managed care percentage.
Okay, talk to us more about that because it's a big one. Yeah.
What's impacting our industry substantially, you know, managed care, we knew OTC was coming and it's still early enough that a lot of the data, we don't really see how much is being taken out of our database, but managed care has been here long enough and we've seen lots of practices, but very often what I see when I pull the unit data, I'll see an office that might have been doing 500 units private pay in 2019, and now they're doing 250 private pay and they're doing 500 managed care. So they're clinic time is being sucked up by managed care, but their revenue per hour is drastically lower, which also impacts the value because again, the operation of the business has to produce cash flow, an excess cash flow that would then increase the value of the business to be sold to an investor. So managed care percentage is, you know, the question that was in all of our minds 4 or 5 years ago. Can you make a managed care business work? Everyone said, there's not enough money there. There's no way no one can make enough money doing managed care. I think that question in my mind has been answered. There's tons of clinics out there that are doing just managed care and they're making a living. They're not making as good of a living as we used to and they're fitting a lot more patients to make that money, but it does drastically impact your value because the margins and how much revenue is being produced by your audiologist per hour is drastically lower. So that's going to impact the valuation. It also impacts who would buy it because there are some of these bigger groups that aren't doing managed care or they're only doing a small amount. So the percentages that I see that's healthy, if someone's doing 70% private pay, 30% managed care from a unit amount, so not revenue, because revenue, sometimes it can be 50-50 on units, but you're only producing 8% of your revenue, which if you know those numbers, it might make you rethink how you're working through that. And again, I'm still so surprised at how many people are taking third party, but not effectively charging through services and appointments, and they're leaving that money on the table.
I see it a lot. If you're an audiologist who wants to grow your practice, we've got a free expert guide to help you achieve your goals. It's called The Only Thing. This expert guide is the only thing you need to increase appointments, sales, and profits for your audiology and hearing aid practice. The Only Thing will show you how to increase new patient calls by 5 to 57 a month, schedule more new patients each week, help more people, and increase revenue. It's the best resource I know for growing your audiology practice. Get your free copy at medpb.com/mastery. The link is also in the show notes. Back to the show. I'll tell you one of the things I'm running into with, you know, how much it's worth is they're being told by certain people that, oh, it's usually like 0.7 to 0.9 of your sales. And I'm like, no, I'm glad to hear you say cash flow because it's based on the cash flow. Whether they go get a loan from the bank, the SBA, or manufacturer, There has to be cash flow in the business to be able to show that they can actually pay back the loan as well as pay themselves so that they're not starving to death in the process. And another thing I didn't hear you mention was making sure that you stay up on your credit. Years ago, I learned a lesson the hard way where I had somebody who was ready to buy a practice. Everything made sense, plenty of cash flow, but their personal credit was so bad that the deal just sunk overnight. And so keeping track of your credit, you want to talk a little bit about that and how important that is to be able to buy a practice for those on the other side that are looking to buy?
Absolutely. So advice I would give it to an individual who's looking to purchase a practice, I agree with you 100%, Kevin. You need to have strong credit. The other thing is there's two reasons businesses fail: lack of capital, lack of knowledge. So when you look at buying an audiology clinic, if you're a third year audiologist out there, you've been working for the VA for 5 years and it's your dream to own a practice, you need to have two things. One, you need to have a written business plan. And I wrote a 13-page business plan, and it was as simple as I downloaded a template off of Word and I went through, and when I read the first executive summary, I had to Google, what's an executive summary? Like, I had to think about, what are they asking me for me in this business plan? I didn't know, right? But I wrote that full business plan. I did projections. I understood what the profit and loss looked like. So before I bought my first business, I understood the correlation of the numbers. So if you want to be a practice owner, write a business plan. And so often I'm surprised that when I talk to somebody about that, that's a pretty straightforward offer or recommendation, and then they won't do it. And honestly, if you don't have the self-discipline to sit down and create a 15-page document of how you're going to operate, you probably won't be successful as a business owner. You need to be able to have that kind of pushing yourself. And the other thing is you need capital. And if you have $5,000, you're not ready to be a business owner. And then the question that people always ask me, well, it's hard to get a hold of money. Yeah, it is. It's also hard to run a business and manage money. So if you're going to be a business owner, if you make $100,000 a year right now as an audiologist, well, figure out how to live on 50 and save 30. Pretty simple. Do that for 3 years. Now you have 90. Now you're ready to be a business owner. You need capital and you need financial discipline. I always thought I could out-earn my stupidity. So I made a lot of dumb decisions when I was young, and I made some dumb ones with debt. And luckily I started reading books and realizing that I had to get myself in line. And when I learned how to manage my $4,000 or $5,000 monthly budget, that equated to when I was managing $40,000, $50,000 and $300,000 and $400,000. But those muscles that I built learning how to manage my money personally helped me to be a good business owner, because then I could not spend all the money that was in the account and make good decisions. So again, credit, capital, knowledge, dive in and reading books about it, finding individuals that you can talk to about what that takes. And that's partly why I do the coaching and consulting, is that I do love sharing the knowledge about this industry with individuals. And I like getting on the call with someone and giving them some of these tools and having some homework to go work on that. I love bringing someone in as a first-time owner. It was the best decision I ever made. It was a scary decision. I was worried about it. So glad I did it. And I'm glad I was able to build it and then sell and be on the other side of it. And if you have that aspiration, you should do it and be aggressive, but don't just jump off the deck into the water. Figure out how you're going to swim.
Well, then going into your coaching stuff, what do you find is probably the 3 to 5 most important things when you start working with a coaching client? Are there some trends that you're seeing? Are there some things that you can let people be aware of that you start to look at? You'd mentioned a couple of things: spending too much on your staff, which I get it, you want to have good people, but not enough on marketing. That sounds like one of the things you find. What else?
Yeah. And again, I want to make sure to stay on the staffing side. I want to pay people really, really well. I had an individual came in and the job paid salary, 60,000 plus commission. And they said, I want to make 90. And I said, gosh, I want you to make 150. But let me help you understand how to make 150, what we have to produce in revenue. And this is how you can make 200. And aligning with your staff, you want to pay them great, especially with inflation today. It's expensive to live and people can't live on what we used to pay. So by all means, when I say staffing's high, I'm not meaning I want to reduce the staffing. I want to make their job more effective so they can produce more revenue. And I think that's back to having a really good plan. The thing with consulting clients, it really does come back to the numbers and the goal. Those are the two functions that we're balancing out. What are your internal goals? Do you want to work a day a week, 3 days a week, 5 days a week? Do you want to grow to have 20 locations? Or do you want to have 3 really healthy locations and you want to spend a month in Europe? Those things are all possible when you're a business owner. So I think where I start the conversation, Kevin, is you have the ability to engineer the life you want to have. So let's start with the big picture of doing some dreaming. Let's dream about what you want. Do you want 100 locations or do you want 3 locations? And what do you want to take off your plate? So start with dreaming, and then we start to convert that into numbers. What does that look like from a goal side of what revenue we need to do? And I think the thing with business is no business can be static and just stand still. It's either going to die or grow. So you should be growing every year. So I'm usually encouraging clients that, you know, if our industry is growing 3-4%, your business should at least grow 10%. That's not a big goal. you could go 10%. And how are you going to make sure that happens so that you're healthy and there's margin there? So goal setting is a big one. I love setting goals. It's really fun to hit goals. They can be scary though, because you can also miss them. I think that this concept of goal setting, and if anybody's ever, you know, heard like the Grant Cardone stuff of 10X, you got to make this massive stretch goal. And to be honest, I'm not a huge Grant Cardone fan, but I like the idea of the stretch goal. But I always struggle too with, if I make this big goal and then we don't hit it, how does that work? So one area that I found to be really effective for myself and my organization, and something I teach consulting clients, is you should have your target goal, your benchmark, and then your break even. These three tiers really help us to operate on, if I want to do $1 million in revenue, great, we're going to do $1 million in revenue. Or for a single office, let's look at it this way. If that single office breaks, the break even is $27,000, you need to make sure you and your staff know that at $27,000, you break even. So when you do $30,000 in revenue per month with one location, two employees, okay, we just barely broke even. Then I want that person to also know the benchmark, that's like $45,000. That means they're making money, I'm making a little, we're not doing great, but we're okay, I'm not mad. But our target's going to be $75,000, and we're going to stretch and try to get to that. And if we hit 64, hey, we're still making good money. I'm making money. They're making money. And we're going to work together on how to get it up to 80. But we have that stretch goal. So we're reaching for to kind of push us. Once we're above benchmark, I know the employees aren't concerned about their job and concerned about their performance, that they're doing well. But if they're below that benchmark, they should be concerned, because that means I'm taking money out of my bank to support that office. And that's a scary thing. And I've worked with clients who had a lot of capital, and all of a sudden, two or three offices started leaking money per month and they didn't realize it. And a year later, they've got $150,000 less in their bank and they didn't realize it was where it was leaking from.
Yep. So walk me through the benchmarking. You said have a target, have a benchmark, and then have a break even. What's the difference between benchmarking and break even again?
Yeah. So benchmark would be, in a single office, my benchmark with most of my locations was in the $40,000, depending on fixed expenses and marketing.
So just an average to shoot for.
Yeah.
Okay.
So at $45,000 with two employees, with my marketing budget for that specific market, if we hit $45,000 in revenue, I could pay the provider a good wage. I, as an individual, was making money and it was okay. We're okay at that number. Break even was, you know, $27,000, $30,000. When we're at that number, we're losing money. So recognize when we're losing it versus when we hit a benchmark of we're okay. And then I want that same office stretching towards, what's our stretch goal? That we want to do this $70,000, $80,000 per month per provider.
All right. Well, great. Well, thanks for clarifying. All right, Jesse, what we're getting towards the end. Is there anything else you want to mention before I get into wrapping this call up? Things that I didn't ask that I should have.
I want to just pass on one compliment to you since I'm here speaking with you. You know, we were at a conference together speaking, and as I was getting ready to do my presentation, I realized as I was the material I was teaching on that it was almost 10 years ago, I was sitting on a call with you and you told me this information.
Oh, no kidding.
Jesse, you need to know your cost per call, cost per lead, cost per appointment. And you were the one that told me that. And I'm standing in front of an audience telling a bunch of audiologists this, and you're sitting there. And I thought at that moment, I need to make sure I thank you for telling me that information, because as a young owner, I listened and I went, okay, this makes sense. So I guess that's the part of this, is that you're going to be the same person in 10 years, except for the people you meet and the books you read. So I would encourage you, read lots of books and find lots of smart people. And that was what, talking to you that day, it helped me. You built my first website. You helped me understand what it looked like for marketing. And I grew on that to grow my practice. And so, you know, that's why I'm glad to join you today to talk about what our industry is going through. And to be honest, a couple of years ago, I was pretty negative. Part of the reason I thought about selling was because I was pretty concerned about our industry. But I've really been encouraged as I'm working with so many more audiology groups that our industry has some runway, and I'm working with some great clients out there that are doing great things. And our industry, the ability for us to help patients, and if you can pair a great experience with a measurable outcome for a patient, that is missing in most markets. When I look at most markets, they're selling a lot of hearing aids, but not a lot of patients are walking into an office where they're getting an amazing experience that's coupled with a measurable outcome of the very best hearing. So if you have a clinic like that, and it doesn't matter what location you're in, you're going to thrive. And I'm a lot more optimistic about our industry today than I was a couple of years ago.
Yeah, same. In fact, we're investing millions, as you know, in the audiology to help more people. We believe that there's still a great opportunity for audiology and hearing aid practices, and we're putting our money and mouth behind it. So thank you for saying that, Jesse. I think that's something the listeners would need to hear, and they don't hear it enough. Well, Jesse, thank you for being here. Appreciate the compliment too. That was very nice of you. I always say the secret to originality is not revealing your sources, but I appreciate the plug. Thank you again for taking time out of your busy day. I know you've got a lot going on. We really appreciate you having here. The call was amazing. We'll probably have you as a guest again sometime in the future. Thank you.
Look forward to it, Kevin. Appreciate your time.
Before we wrap it up, though, tell everybody how they can get a hold of you.
I would love to connect with any of you who are wondering about what my clinic's worth, audiologyacquisitions.com and Bristol Group. So you Google Jesse Aldis and Audiology Acquisition, you'll find me. Would love to connect and happy to do an evaluation, help you to guide whether you want to sell now or in 5 years. Would love to connect.
Great. Thank you, Jesse. Have a great day.
Take care.